Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Marcia Joyner, your TS radio host with Betrayed by Hospice, where we talk honestly about the reality of what hospice has become over the past two decades. For those who have listened to previous talk shows, my information may be repetitive, but it's important for those who do not know the truth to hear what's going on. While we all believe that hospice came to families to provide compassionate care for those people who were at the end of their natural life, hospice was changing all the rules, and we had no clue. Hopefully, no one played a bad practical joke on you today, as it's April Fool's Day, but I would ask you to say rabbit, 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 as in three times, because there is an old folklore that states if you say that three times on the first day of each month, it brings good luck, and I'm all for that anytime. So rabbit, rabbit, rabbit to everyone. In 2017, my mother was a victim of a hospice facility in Georgia where she was drugged into a coma with morphine, Ativan, and fentanyl until she died a cruel, painful, and slow death from the drugs, starvation, and dehydration. The details of her story are archived at Betrayed by Hospice, dated July the 10th, 2019, so I won't go into the horrible details about that. I say this so that you know I have personally witnessed murder by hospice, and that is why I do these shows, to warn people about the dangers of blindly trusting the medical profession. Genevieve, can you put us on mute?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it picks up if you're moving. Okay, I'm sorry. It took me 6 months to find out that my mom's case was not unique when I found hospicepatients.org and spoke with Ron Panzer, who told me about stealth euthanasia, which was happening everywhere. It's in front of us, and we don't suspect their complicity. My journey then took me on a new direction of warning others and continuing to send letters to the government and anybody else I could think of to let them know about the atrocities of the now hospice. I'd like to begin by making a few clarifications. Don't confuse hospice care with palliative care, as there is a distinction. Both provide relief from pain and comfort, but palliative care can begin with a diagnosis along with treatment, while hospice care is supposed to begin after treatment of the disease is stopped when it is clear that the person is not going to survive the illness. This definition of hospice palliative care is not always true, as many of us have witnessed. The other thing is hospice palliative care, aka stealth euthanasia, is not the same as assisted suicide or medical aid in dying, which we'll talk about later tonight with our guest. Assisted suicide is when a patient requests the doctor provide drugs to them to end their own life for whatever reason. They knowingly take the drug and never wake up. Hospice is euthanizing people against their knowledge and certainly without their consent, in a drawn-out, slow, cruel, and painful death. Hospice originally was created to help the actively dying cross over peacefully and minimize pain. It was for people who were admitted to hospice because they had a terminal illness like end-stage cancer or liver or kidney failure that could no longer be treated with medications. Over the years, the criteria for admission became more lax to allow more people to be certified. People who could be successfully treated with medication for illnesses such as congestive heart failure, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, better known as COPD, or dementia. Then that criteria was further watered down to add people who went to the hospital too many times for breathing issues, dehydration, anemia, or even broken bones. Going to the hospital 3 or 4 times is referred to as a frequent flyer, and it can get you flagged so that before you leave the hospital, someone comes in to talk to you about enrolling in hospice because they want to help and make your life easier by coming to you instead of you having to go to your doctor's office or back to the hospital. Beware. They don't come to you because they want to help you. You've been flagged as requiring too much medical attention, costing too much money. Now a person can even qualify with something as simple as having lost the ability to dress or feed themselves, or because they're incontinent. No one questioned the criteria scope creeping because everybody believes hospice is compassionate and wanting to help people. This is a fairy tale at best and a murder story in the end. The why this changed is because the elderly and the disabled people cost more money to treat them than it does to eliminate them. I know how cool this sounds, and by some, a conspiracy, but it is a fact. As you often hear, follow the money. The government saves money through Medicare and Medicaid by not treating the patient for hospital visits, running tests, kidney dialysis, or any other treatment. People have learned that hospice is a lucrative business, so they buy the facilities where they have a few nurses, aides, and a medical director, and they set up shop. They give bonuses to other doctors who refer the patient to their facility, and it's all legal. So here we have the government saving money, greedy people making money, and the patient, your mom, your dad, your spouse, or you, paying the ultimate price, your life. As our previous guest, Michelle Duers, author of Killing for Profit, The Dark Side of Hospice, stated recently, that's why hospices are trying to win your business and have you enroll with them, and the hospital staff are part of the dynamics. It gets you out of their facility and into hospice, and hospice gets to chalk up the death to their credit. Again, I know this sounds cruel, but it is the reality. Hospice is hastening people's death with drugs such as morphine, Ativan, Haldol, Seroquel, and Fentanyl, which causes starvation and dehydration and ultimately a horrible death. And not because the patient was dying when they enrolled or that it was believed that they would die naturally in 6 months. Let's be clear. If you gave these same drugs in the combination, duration, and timing to a strong, young, and healthy individual, that person would die within the same time frame. So how can death certificates state congestive heart failure, cancer, kidney failure, COPD, or various other things listed? Because consider this. If a person, a group of people, or a facility would stoop to over-medicating someone to die, murder, do you think they would have any problem falsifying a death certificate? Of course not. And as I always try to point out, not all hospices are bad. Not all hospices hasten people's death. Some are pro-life, but many are not. And you need to be aware of the dangers. Hospice was once a very good facility, and some still are, and they could be again, but they would have to go back to their initial intent. If you know for a fact that you or your loved one is at the end stage cancer or does have liver or kidney failure and there is no hope and they are in a great deal of pain, then you may indeed opt for hospice care for palliative pain management. But drugs should not be a one-size-fits-all. Before they give you or your loved one drugs, research the side effects for yourself and do not blindly trust them. I by no means am advocating that you should allow yourself or your loved one to remain in pain. Sometimes the patient may be anxious and they give them Ativan or the same thing as lorazepam, but perhaps by showing them pictures of fond memories or their grandchildren or spouses or just talking to them or singing to them may calm them down so that they don't need additional drugs. Isn't it worth a try before a nurse injects whatever they want into them? And speaking of this, I'd like to talk briefly about the drugs that are being administered to our elderly and how all rules of risk are not being practiced under hospice. In fact, their own documentation in the Center for Medicare and Medicaid states that staff have to have knowledge of the indications, side effects, drug interactions, compatibility, and dose limits of administered medications. But the fact is that once you're in hospice, your safety doesn't count. These drugs would kill a healthy person. But that is their intent. There are circumstances where morphine for pain and Ativan for anxiety are okay in small doses, but not always, and you need to make sure they aren't increasing the dose or the frequency, especially at nighttime when no one is around to advocate for the patient. Morphine, or often referred to as Roxanol, is for pain, but the person doesn't have to be put into a coma to relieve pain. Contrary to what hospice staff will say, morphine is not always used to help breathing. That's what they told us about our mom. Oh, it'll help her breathe. The fact is, it can create a problem with breathing, and trouble swallowing. Other side effects are vomiting, constipation, dizziness, drowsiness, agitation, confusion, hallucinations, or stomach pains, and it even states in the warnings that older patients may be more sensitive to the side effects of this drug, especially the confusion and the dizziness and drowsiness and shallow breathing. And symptoms of an overdose may include slow or shallow breathing, a slow heartbeat, and coma. So this is the drug they're giving them to ease their breathing. Fentanyl is 100 times stronger than morphine and 50 times stronger than heroin. And it, too, has its side effects, same as morphine. Ativan, which is used for anxiety, may cause drowsiness, dizziness, loss of coordination, headache, nausea, blurred vision, constipation, the same type of things, that hallucinations, that are happening with the morphine. It can also cause signs of an infection, as a fever. Older adults may be more sensitive to the side effects and may not experience relief of anxiety, and it could have the opposite effect. How does hospice know when they're giving this to your loved ones? They don't. It's a one-size-fits-all drug regime. Seroquel and Haldol, you may have heard them talk about a ham sandwich. That's Haldol, Ativan, and morphine. And some nurses joke about that. If you upset them, we'll give you a ham sandwich. This is no joking matter. Seroquel and Haldol are antipsychotic drugs that alter the consciousness and can adversely affect the ability to interact with others. And FDA has warned against using these on the elderly, and it can double the risk of death. Haldol is used to treat psychotic disorders like schizophrenia, to control a motor movement like Tourette's syndrome, and to treat severe behavior problems in children. Seroquel is used to treat schizophrenia and bipolar disorder or major depressive disorder. What? So these are the drugs that they're treating our vulnerable loved ones with, drugs that can cause trouble breathing, seeing, swallowing, concentrating, that can cause death. Drugs that are meant to treat schizophrenia, Tourette syndrome, bipolar disorder. Our loved ones don't have these things. These drugs cause them not to be able to communicate how they feel. They can't drink water. They can't eat. They can't talk to their loved ones. And if they moan, they give them more drugs because they say they're in pain. And those drugs cause more symptoms, so they give them more drugs. Does anybody else see a glaring problem here and red flags all over the place? That's why I say do your research. Check what is happening to your loved one before it's too late. You don't have to choose hospice, and you can revoke them verbally and then in writing at any point if you do not agree with the plan that they are doing or they want to do with your loved one. You have a say-so, and if you don't, please get a durable power of attorney in place now so you can advocate for your loved one. HaloVoice.org, that's one word, HaloVoice.org, has examples per state that you can use. So let's talk money. Each year there is a cap on Medicare and Medicaid that they will pay per patient in hospice. That is just under $30,000 now. That amount is based on the number of patients times the money. So someone in a facility could be there 3 days or 2 months, 6 months, 10 months, 12 months. It doesn't matter as long as that amount of money times the number of patients isn't exceeded. The daily rate differs on how much care is required. So the facility only makes money on the days that they care for the person. I know I sound like a broken record, but it's important you don't trust, blindly trust. You do your own research. And if they give you the pamphlet that shows the signs of dying, keep in mind the signs of an overdose are the same as signs of dying, and they want you to believe your loved one miraculously came in here, was sitting up, eating, was fine, and now all of a sudden they're dying. That's just not true. Don't listen. Their lies are built on the tried and true. They are manipulated. They manipulate us into believing what they say because we're taught that they're compassionate, they're medical people, and we just blindly believe them. Not anymore. They used to be. Not now. They're not for the terminally ill or the actively dying. I've talked to so many people who lost their loved ones to hospice, and not because they were dying, but because their death was hastened and they didn't know what was going on until it was too late. That's what we all have in common. The other thing we have in common is we would like to go back in time and change what happened, because now we've seen, we know what they did. You can't prove it. Nobody would listen, even if you have your medical records. And that's something you should get. If you lost a loved one, get your medical records. We can't unsee what happened to us. Most of us have nightmares over that over and over again of watching our loved ones be murdered slowly. So how can we fight back? My personal thoughts, if your loved one is not terminal or actively dying and they don't require morphine to ease the pain, consider other options. And even if they do need something for pain, don't allow them their death to be hastened by giving them too much medication. You know what they wanted. Honor their wishes. Do not let people talk you into believing hospice is the only option. There are other options. If you Google, go to payingforseniorcare.com or medicare.gov and look under home health services, or even AARP.org has home care services that you can get for your loved one. I belong to a Facebook group, Murdered by Hospice. Several of its new members have heard our stories, and they have made a conscious decision not to enroll their loved ones. So we are reaching people. People are hearing this, and they're saving their loved ones from a hastened, cruel death. I feel good about that. Learn how, if you sign a do not resuscitate, It puts you at risk of the medical staff doing nothing if you become ill. They don't have to treat anything. Knowledge is power. Do your research. Make informed decisions. Tonight, our guest is Genevieve Wilson, who is the Director of Chapter Development with Georgia Right to Life. Genevieve has been working with the Ministry of Valuing the Sanctity of Life for over 30 years. Her first involvement with Georgia Right to Life was at the local level with Gwinnett Chapter, where she held the position of Education Director and served as the president for over 8 years. She was Public Relations Director for 2 years and Co-Executive Director from 2011 to 2015, and currently is the Director of Chapter Development since 2001. She has been actively involved in peaceful demonstrations against those who do not value the life of the innocent baby in the womb. She was actively involved with the establishment of Georgia Right to Life and Personhood Alliance and has served as Georgia Delegate and is currently serving on the Personhood Board. An interesting fact about Genevieve is she lives on a goat farm with her husband, Ken. They have 3 children and 9 grandchildren. The fundamental purpose of Georgia Right to Life is to engage in actions that will restore respect and effective legal protection for all innocent human beings from earliest biological beginning until natural death. Their aim is to communicate that a person is sacred by virtue of the fact that we are all created in the image of God and that all life must be respected and protected regardless of race, sex, age, or condition of dependency. They work to inform government officials of pro-life policies. It is my pleasure to welcome Genevieve Wilson to our show tonight to share with us what Georgia Right to Life is working on. So, Genevieve, I'll turn it over to you.
Well, hi, Marcia. I just want to thank you for the opportunity to talk to your listeners. You know, the sanctity of life, whether it's at the beginning of life or at the end of life, is really the most important issue that we face. And yet we know that there are so many people that do not understand the things that you've just shared with us about the end of life, but also some of the things about the beginning of life. And that is Georgia Right to Life's main focus. Over 80% of what we do is education. We don't have the means or they don't want to. The media and the networks and so forth have never shown an abortion. And why is that? They show all kinds of horrible, I mean, very graphic surgery on TV nowadays, and yet not an abortion. Why? They don't tell the truth about people at the end of their lives. They try to make it sound like if we don't support hospice, if we don't support assisted suicide, that we are just not wanting people to have their rights. And really, it's the exact opposite, because these euphemisms and this culture of death that our culture is in the stranglehold of is the one who is denying rights.
Absolutely, which is choice is an illusion. Right?
Yes, ma'am, it certainly is.
Absolutely. I know there are currently 9 states plus the District of Columbia within the United States that have accepted assisted suicide, or they call it death with dignity or physician-assisted dying or aid in dying laws, and there are several different names for it. The states, in case somebody doesn't know what they are and if your state is or is not listed, but the current states that have agreed to assisted suicide, I'm going to call it assisted suicide, are California, Colorado, Hawaii, Maine, New Jersey, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, in Montana, along with District of Columbia. 16 more states are considering it this year, including Georgia. And I know that a lot of the legislative laws have been put aside because of the coronavirus. So can you talk to us about who is pushing this agenda and what is Georgia's position?
Well, the organization that is promoting what they euphemistically call medical aid in dying, which sounds, you know, oh, that sounds like a good thing. And their name is Compassion and Choices, which, boy, that sounds good too, you know. I mean, I definitely want compassion and I want choices. But the reality is that Compassion and Choices name used to be the Hemlock Society. And I don't know if your listeners are aware, but hemlock is a very strong poison. And so that name was more realistic, but they decided it didn't hide what they were trying to do, so they changed their name to Compassion and Choices. And Compassion and Choices, you mentioned the 16 states that currently have some form of an assisted suicide law in their legislature. I would bet that by the end of the year, that 16 grows to 20-something, because it has been over 20 every year. I don't know exactly how many years now, but for a while. And it is Compassion and Choices, a.k.a. Hemlock Society, who goes into the states and finds a person that they can convince that this is something that their state needs. And so then they have a legislator who they work with, and the laws, while they do vary minutely, you know, not in the over in the large scale of things, but they are very similar. And a number of them are called, like in Georgia, it's called the Georgia Death with Dignity Act. It was introduced in this legislative session that we are currently in. And you are right, our legislature is on recess and has been, for at least 2 weeks now. And I don't expect that they're going back anytime soon. So Georgia actually has a law on the books against assisted suicide. So one would think, okay, well, Georgia, they're not going to come bother you because you have a law that says, you know, you can't have assisted suicide. It's against the law to assist someone in suicide in Georgia. Well, that's not the case. As you can see, they did come to Georgia, and that's something all of your listeners should be aware of. And something else that they should be aware of is that when assisted suicide is introduced, it is introduced as a right. It is introduced as a person needing to have autonomy over when and how they die. But there are certain what they refer to as safety guards in the legislation. Like one of them almost always is that the person has only 6 months or left to live. Well, these safeguards are really just window dressing on a very bad piece of legislation, because what is actually happening is that people who may have a year, 2 years, 10 years to live are being told that they don't have that time to live, and so they think that they're going to die. Also, another thing that you hear frequently with assisted suicide bills is that the people are in pain. They need to be able to end their pain. But yet, in Oregon, I believe, is the state that I'm thinking of. It could be Washington State, but one of those two states, their report, they are required, they have legal assisted suicide, and they are required to report on various factors around the people that are taking the pill to kill themselves. And one of the things is that the reason that the overwhelming majority of people choose to take a medication to kill themselves is not because of pain. Not at all. It's not even the top two reasons. It's not even the top three reasons. The top reasons are not wanting to be a burden, not wanting to be able to control their dying. So it really, so two things right off the bat, two safeguards, only having 6 months to live and to take care because people are in pain, fly right out the window. Doctors cannot predict when we're going to die. And I'm sure that your listeners know of someone who was given a certain amount of time who lived longer than that. Now, do people live less than what the doctor might tell them? Absolutely. But the point here is that we don't know, and we don't want to make an assumption that, oh, yeah, you're going to be dead in less than 6 months. So, yeah, sure, go ahead and take this pill. The other safeguard that is very troubling is that you go to the doctor and you get this medication, and then you go home and you take it, supposedly. Well, what if you want to wait a little while? What if, you know, the pill is laying around your house and you're still deciding what you want to do, but maybe someone, a family member or a caregiver,
a child,
decides, yes, gets that pill. That is extremely dangerous. And not only is that extremely dangerous, but if there is any motivation to speed up your decision so that someone else can get their heritage, their whatever you might be leaving them, there is no oversight as to who is there when you take that pill, and whether you actually take it or someone forces you to take it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the final straw that breaks the camel's back, that is just unbelievable to me, is that the language in the legislation specifically says that the cause of death will not be assisted suicide, but will be some other underlying physical cause or physical problem that the patient has, that the person has. So those are some of the reasons that you really don't want assisted suicide.
Well, you don't. And going back to the death certificates with hospice, they're fictitious. Those documents
yeah.
are falsified. I know they are. And my mom's was. And you can easily be coerced. Say that somebody has dementia, because now we have started to look at patients with dementia as non-entities, not human anymore. You know, they don't know when it's time to eat or drink, so just let them starve to death. You know, that's no big deal. If they don't want to eat, don't make them eat. And it would be so easy to coerce someone in deciding something into saying, I want to die, when they may not even know what they're saying, and maybe at the time they say it, but as you stated, they have a different decision later on. They don't want to do it. So someone can be coerced into it. Somebody else can force them to take the medication when they do have a second thought. There are no safeguards in this. You're absolutely
there are
right.
Absolutely none. Right. The very things that they point to as safeguards are not. And another thing is right now they are promoting assisted suicide as a right to die, but we already see, I mean, very wise people said we have to be careful because this right to die is going to become a duty to die. And we already see that happening in some of the states that have had assisted suicide for a long time, and in Europe where the same thing has happened. There have been instances where an insurance company refuses to pay for cancer medication, but then after they in the same notification that they refuse to pay for the cancer medication, they let them know, but we will pay for assisted suicide.
Right. That happened in Canada also. Right.
Yeah.
Where they do have euthanasia is legal.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a way, again, it's a way to call the people. And those people who are elderly or who are disabled for whatever reason, then society has gotten to the point, which I know later we're going to talk about this COVID-19, but society has come to the point where we don't value human life. We don't value it at conception, and we don't value it when someone is considered a useless feeder or they're not viable to society because they're not earning a living, they're not going out and doing anything, and they're elderly or they're disabled, so therefore they don't deserve life. Who made somebody else God to decide what somebody does and does not deserve? And the farther that we go down this slippery slope, the more trouble that we are in as a humane society. Animals take better care of their offsprings than we do of, you know, our like people. And I say like people. All people are like people. All people are our people, and we should be protecting them against somebody who wants to do them harm. And sadly, assisted suicide, you can go in and just to say, I'm depressed. You know, the young girl who was raped as a child, and she never could get over that. So she just decided, I want to die. She's a child. I think she was like 17 or 18 years old. You know, and children are getting together and making suicide packs. They think it's cool. So if you want to come into a state and talk about, oh, we're going to, you know, authorize and make assisted suicide legal, then what are we telling our young children? You know, the generation,
life
it's okay to
matter.
Commit. That's right. That's right.
Yep.
And that's wrong.
Yeah.
Life does
it
matter.
It absolutely is.
And it matters for
it
everybody.
Does. And when someone is depressed or is thinking they want to commit suicide, a lot of times it's a call for help. And what does it tell them if we say, oh, here, I'll take you to the doctor so you can get a pill to accomplish it?
Mm-hmm.
It tells them that we don't love them, that we don't value them.
Oh, it does.
Really,
we don't want to be bothered. It's a burden. And let's go back to what you said earlier. It becomes a burden. That person is a burden. And you don't ever want someone to feel like they're a burden to society.
It is very puzzling to me how when you have a young child, already a born child, and you know you take care of them, and I mean usually newborns, you get up in the middle of the night, you have to feed them, you have to change their diaper, you have to bathe them, you have to clothe them, all that kind of stuff. Why is it that when we get older or we have a disability where we need assistance, that that's considered a burden? But when you're taking care of a young person, a child, it's not a burden. What makes the difference? And I think it's love. I think
we're such a, the society has become so hedonistic that that's all we care about is ourselves. And we don't want to be bothered with somebody else. And my dad's 92. He's being a little snowbird right now with my sister in Florida because of the cold. But, you know, there's no way that we would ever, you know, put him in a facility. We're in the position we don't have to do that. But he's valuable to us because he's our dad and we love him and we will protect him. But, you know, other people may not be in that situation where that they can have their loved one live with them. I get that. But you don't turn your back on your family. And going to, you know, the people that, you know, someone goes in and says, you know, I'm depressed and I just want to kill myself, that is a, what is it? The saying is it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And that person needs to be given, you know, I don't like that word counseling, but counseling. But they need to be given love and they need to know that you are important, you do matter, and people love you.
Yes,
you affect people positively in your life, and people need to understand that you're good. We love you, and there's not enough of that.
Absolutely. No, there isn't. I think a lot of time. I mean, what you said about us being so selfish that we don't want to be bothered is a part of the problem, and the other part of the problem with someone who has a disability, or as you get older and you're not able to do some of the things that you did when you were younger, I think it makes us uncomfortable. I think we don't know what to do, we don't know what to say, you know, and so the solution is, well, it's making, I don't know that we do it cognitively, but I'm uncomfortable, so this must not be good for you. So we're going to let it, you know, we're going to take care of it for you.
And that's just wrong on every single level.
On every level, I agree.
On every level. So one of the other things, and Georgia is my home state. I think I've told you that. And that's
yes.
where
uh-huh.
my mother was murdered. But I had heard that Georgia had come up with the heartbeat law, and I was so proud of my home state in coming up with that. And I want you to explain where we are on that and why that really has not happened yet. But then the movie industry came out and stated, because Walking Dead, which happens to be one of my favorite shows, Walking Dead was... the movie was taken there in the state of Georgia. And so the movie theater decides to get involved in this, and they come out and they say any state that is pro-life, or you want to call it anti-abortion, whichever way you want to state it, but because Georgia was trying to push for the heartbeat law, then the movie industry said, we will give you money if you do not make movies in states that are pro-life. I think that says something really, really sad about our country. I'll just leave it there. But anyway, so tell me what is going on with the heartbeat. What is the heartbeat law, and what is the status of it now?
Well, the heartbeat law is basically was saying that if you could detect the heartbeat in a preborn child, that then the baby could not be killed by abortion. The premise was that the heartbeat is one of the signs, one of the very definitions of being alive. We listen for a heartbeat if someone is shot. What is one of the first things people do? They check to see if you have a pulse. What is pulse?
Mm-hmm.
A pulse is your beating heart. So if the heartbeat is a sign of life at other times of a person's life, then it should be a sign of life in the womb. And see, in 1973, when the Supreme Court ruled Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton, they said they did not know when life began. So in Georgia, they decided that they were going, based on the premise that a heartbeat is a sign of life, therefore, if you can find a heartbeat on a child in the womb, that baby is alive and therefore should be protected. So that's just a a short synopsis of what the thought process was.
Okay. So where does that bill stand now?
Yes, it passed out of the House. It went to the Senate. It passed out of the Senate, and the governor signed it. It was supposed to go into effect on January 1st, but notice I said was supposed to. I can't remember which month, but it was like in June, July,
I think it was
August.
In July. July of 2019, I think.
It was challenged by the ACLU, Planned Parenthood, and other abortion providers. And challenge means that there's going to be a hearing, and the judge is going to decide whether it can go into effect or not. And in the meantime, in addition to challenging it, they also asked the judge to rule that it could not go into effect until a decision was made. So that's where it stands right now. We have no idea when the judge is going to rule, what's going to happen. It's just kind of like hanging there now, not in
court. Well, and now even more so. And now even more so because all the legislative bills have kind of been pushed aside.
Yeah.
The other thing on that that I was thinking about when you were talking is if you are driving drunk and you hit a pregnant person and they both die, it is called double homicide.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
Obviously they are looking at that child in the womb as being a person because otherwise you would not be charged with a double homicide.
Right.
So
it doesn't make any sense, does it?
No, not to many of us. So there's another bill, a pro-life strategy that Georgia's working on. It's called personhood. And that also, that affects the baby, but it also affects the vulnerable elderly who are being euthanized daily. So can you talk to me about personhood?
Yes, I'd be happy to. There were some observations that Georgia Right to Life made, and that was, if you look at history, whenever atrocities were committed to a people group or genocide against them, their personhood was denied in some way. So let's take Native American Indians. I think everybody is aware that history definitely bears out that we murdered, I don't know how many, of Native American Indians and forced them west and into reservations. Legally, they were not considered persons. And the black man, black people, I shouldn't say, not just men, the same thing. There was a court ruling that actually said that black people were only 3/5 of a person. I mean, how you could even come to that conclusion, how that would even be possible, I don't know. But that's how they could be owned and how they could be treated whatever way the person who owned them wanted to. And then also, of course, in Nazi Germany, the Jews lost all their rights. They no longer had personhood. They were victims of genocide and just horrible torture and atrocities. So because of that observation and because during the United States Supreme Court hearing of the Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton cases where they ruled, one of the justices said to the attorney who was arguing for abortion, if the personhood of the unborn child, he called it a fetus, if the personhood of the fetus could be proved, your case would fall apart. And she laughs and she says, yes, you are absolutely right. So between the observation of history and what happened during that hearing, we observe that personhood, if we could pass an amendment saying that a human being is a person from the earliest biological beginning until a natural death, it would, I don't want to say cure, what's the word? It would solve our problems with the idea that human life can be expendable, that it's a commodity to be trivialized.
Devalued.
That's the right word. You're absolutely
devalued.
Right. That's devalued is exactly right. The let's see, where was I? The personhood really just means the right to have rights. Because if you are a human person under the Constitution, you have rights. And that's why it's so important.
And that's with the elderly and the disabled too, because their well-being is being threatened daily because of the Medicare cuts.
Well, their lives are being threatened daily in so many ways, between Medicare cuts, rationing, assisted suicide. I mean, it's in on a lot of different fronts. It really is.
Right. I guess it comes down to that, you know, whether you value someone's life or not. And,
yeah,
you know, they determine health care is too expensive for them, so let's just euthanize them, get rid of them because they cost too much money. In the Holocaust, I have been reading about that, and they called them useless feeders.
Yeah.
Because they were not productive to society. And even though that wasn't true, you know, there were people worked then, that was not true at all, but that's what they called them to justify what they did to them.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
It shows how that is a perfect example of how the framing the issue can influence how we think if we don't stop to ask questions. You know, we just kind of take in what the media tells us, and we really can't do that. I mean, you pointed that out very articulately when you were talking about hospice and the medication and how they can convince us of almost anything, because they're the experts, right? They're the ones who are supposed to be caring for our loved ones. We're supposed to trust them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah. But
well,
we're conditioned.
We're manipulated, and we're conditioned that's what that organization stands for. It's kind of like the Boy Scouts. If you look at the Boy Scouts, you know, the leader is supposed to be above board and, you know, be a wonderful human being that you send, you know, your child to on camping trips and et cetera, et cetera. And when you find out that the Boy Scout leader, and I'm not just picking on Boy Scouts, please, I used to be a Boy Scout leader, but when you find out that the Boy Scout leader has done something inappropriate with your child, with your son, you're devastated because you expected a higher moral ground for that. And that's kind of like with hospice. You expect a higher moral ground for hospice people. So when you do find that out, you're very disillusioned because they're supposed to be compassionate. You know, we trust them. And that bubble is burst because now you see, you know, the horns and you see them for what they are. And it's shocking.
Yes,
so
it is.
We're
conditioned. And we should be just as shocked when we learn about the truth behind hospice, when we learn the truth about assisted suicide. We should be just as shocked.
Mm-hmm. We should be appalled.
Yeah, that's a better word.
Yeah. I mean, there's that shock, but there's that I'm appalled that you would try to stand for this, because I can remember with my mom's situation that one particular nurse would say, "You don't want your mom to be in pain now, do you, sweetie?" And every time, you know, we tried to take her to the hospital, you're trying to save her life, and she's talking to you like you're a child, and like she's so concerned. And now, thinking back on that, I just want to grab her and slam dunk her. But at the time, I thought she was sincere. And, you know, even when, you know, we were able to get Mom to drink a little bit of water, I was really excited. And, you know, I said, "Oh, she's drinking a little bit of water." You know, we rub her throat and we get it down. Well, just don't be surprised. Sometimes they'll rally up and seem like they're doing better, but then they take a turn for the worse. And it's like no matter what you would say, she wanted to bust her bubble. Don't get excited about it. Your mom's dying. Suck it up. It's going to happen, you know. So, yeah, they're trained. Okay. Yeah, and I'll go off on that tangent. I'll start ranting and raving in a minute, so I'll stop. So you had Dan Becker, who was a previous president of Georgia Right to Life, and his brother was in an accident. And what did he find out after his brother's accident that you'd like to share with us?
Well, another area that is very sensitive and problematic is organ donation. So our president, Dan Becker, his brother was in an accident. I believe it was motorcycle, but I guess it's not really that significant. He did not regain consciousness. And so the family was involved. In Georgia, we have a law that delineates the decision-making process if the person who is hurt or ill cannot make the decisions for themselves. If they don't have any kind of documentation, then the law gives the order of who gets to make decisions. So first it's the spouse, then it's a child, then it's a parent, so like that. When Dan's brother was in the hospital, the medical team came to them and asked if they said that he was brain dead, and that he couldn't breathe on his own, and they asked if it would be all right to take his organs. And, of course, they said it in such a way as to say, you know, "We're very sorry for your loss, and wouldn't he want his death to have an impact to help others and all of that kind of stuff?" And I don't know how Dan found out, but whether someone told him or what, but he learned that in order for them to harvest your organs, I think everybody knows that the organs have to be fresh, that they have to be...
They can't be from a cadaver.
Right. It can't be a long time between when you die and they remove the organs. Well, what he found out is that his brother's heart was still beating. It wasn't being assisted. He was on a ventilator. And that the cause of his death was going to be the removal of his heart.
That's shocking.
The heart, it is very shocking. Very shocking, because I don't think most people know that.
He didn't let him do it, did he?
No, they didn't. But what they did allow them to do, and once they learned this, there was a little bit of time. I mean, we're not talking weeks, but like a couple of days to see if his brother rallied or anything. And then I don't know who advised them to see if he could breathe without being on the ventilator, that could be a sign as to whether he was really being kept alive by the ventilator or not. And so they did remove the ventilator, and he did pass, but they did not take his organs.
Well, yes, and I like your term harvesting instead of donation, because a lot of times it is harvesting, and you're absolutely right. We had a program with Dr. Paul Byrne, who is a neonatalist.
Yes.
Excellent. And he talked about organ harvesting at that time. That was a very, very good program. I'm looking it up here. Okay, that was on May the 1st, 2019, if anybody wants to go back to listen to that, because it's a very, very good, excellent program about the organ donation. The one thing that he brought up is they will want to do an apnea test on the patient. That's not the same as a sleep apnea. And what happens is they stop the oxygen from the brain for 10 minutes. And in doing that, it causes the brain to swell. So when you look at the brain activity of the patient, it will show that that person is brain dead. So even if they weren't brain dead before, you never want them to perform an apnea test, not a sleep apnea, but an apnea test, because that will cause the brain to swell, which will give you false indications that the person is actually brain dead. So that is another flag. Yeah, that's another flag that you need to be aware of, that because we're not medical people, we're not aware of these things.
No,
so.
And you think it sounds good. You think, let's check and see what's going on.
Who can I help? The other thing that he talks about, and I know that on his site, Legal Guardian is his site, but also Halo Voice has it on their site about being an organ donor, and on your driver's license, if you don't state it on your driver's license, you are considered an organ donor under the Anatomical Gift Act. And so if you don't have something specifically that says, I am not an organ donor, do not take my organs, if you do not have something like that with your driver's license, they can just automatically take your organs under the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act is what it's called, and they can automatically take your organs unless you have something in place. And on halovoice.org and on Life Guardian Foundation, they also have a form in there that you can fill out that says, I am not an organ donor. Because they will let you go, and they'll actually kill you to get your organs. In 2 weeks from now, I have Jennifer Hammond coming on, and she actually was in that situation where she heard the doctors talking about taking her organs. She was 25 years old, and her husband would not permit it, and as it turned out, she came out from under her coma and remembers the doctor saying that, and had her husband just said, yeah, okay, they would have taken, you know, liver, kidney, heart, eyes, whatever. But because her husband refused, she's alive today, and she became a nurse because of that situation. So everything has to be...
There is even, I did not look this up, but there is a scientist who wanted to do research on the human brain when, quote, the person's unconscious, brain dead, you know, they have all of these euphemistic terms. And he found a way to, I think, some kind of fluoroscopic test where you know, the fluoroscope shows different areas of the brain that are involved in different functions. So they connected this test, and I don't remember the name of it, to someone's brain who was considered at best, you know, unconscious, at worst, brain dead. And they would ask them certain questions, and certain areas of the brain would light up based on the question. So, like, if the area of the brain where you're physically active, like running or playing tennis or something, they would ask a question that would cause that area of the brain to light up. So, I mean, how did that happen if the person wasn't on some level aware of what's going
conscious.
On around them?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Those sound like the Holocaust things, horrible things that they did to their victims.
Yeah.
That sounds horrible.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Paul Byrne, another thing that he had stated is that he had been in operating rooms where they had said that the person was brain dead, and they were removing organs, and a tear came down the person's cheek. And supposedly they didn't know and were, you know, out, because they can't give you strong anesthesia, because if they do, then that would render the organ, you know, be put in medicine or, you know, opioids, narcotics into the organ, I guess. And I'm not a doctor. But he had made the comment that they're actually, you know, he has seen patients that have a tear come down, because you are not dead when that happens. And you do have feelings. And as, you know, pointed out from our guest next time, she came out from under it. So just because they say you're brain dead does not mean you are brain dead. So, you know, sorry, I'm not an organ donor.
No,
so
me
one
either.
Question about the personhood. Is Georgia the only state, I meant to ask you that, is Georgia the only state that has the personhood law that you know of?
No, there are other states. Georgia doesn't have the law at this point. We are working to try to get it passed, but that's what our ultimate goal is. There are, I think, 26 states that are part of the organization called Personhood Alliance, and all of them take a personhood approach.
Okay, I'm writing this down because you know, I already told you I'm anal retentive on stuff, so I want to look that up. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So does Georgia Right to Life have pro-life attorneys that can assist people who need them if they're, like, in a situation, you know, maybe with hospice when their loved one is being held against their wishes, or do you know any attorneys that do that type of thing?
Yes, we do. We have a couple of attorneys that we work with, both to give us advice, and that we would ask, you know, if someone needed assistance, that they would be able to help someone who is facing a difficult situation. Maybe, we're going to talk about this in a little bit, I think. Maybe in a situation where the hospital or the medical facility is saying that they don't want to take care of the patient anymore for whatever reason, and so they're kicking them to the curb. Now, they don't literally kick them to the curb, but the bottom line is they're saying, you have to leave, you know, find someplace else. Or sometimes they don't even say, you know, find someplace else. They just say, you know, you're
get out.
Yeah, you have, and you may only have a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important to have pro-life attorneys who will assist you in navigating yet another unfamiliar territory.
Now, is that just for Georgia, or does that cover some of Alabama, or is it just Georgia?
One of the attorneys we work with is actually in Alabama.
Okay.
And he helps us in Georgia. He's very close to the border between Alabama and Georgia, and he is licensed in both Alabama and Georgia.
Not, is he in Dothan?
No, he's further north.
Okay, so we had one of our ladies that was in our group, Nancy Scott, and her mother, Marilyn Leonard, actually died last year. And they had been trying to find an attorney to assist her, and she was in Alabama. So that's why I asked that. Okay. So how can people get in contact with you? Is there, like, a number that they can call you or just to?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
we have
you want to give me that?
And we have a phone number? Sure, I would love to. Okay, the phone number to reach Georgia Right to Life is 770-339-6880. Again, that's 770-339-6880. And the website is pretty easy. It's the initials from Georgia Right to Life. It's grtl.org.
Good. That's very easy.
The first letter of Georgia Right to Life.org.
Okay. Okay, all right. So can you give us some examples of some of the calls you just kind of briefly mentioned, but can you give us some examples of the calls that you've received and some people you've been able to help?
Well, currently we are working with an unusual case. There is a man here in Georgia. He's 50 years old. He was had chronic poor health, in that he had diabetes and was on dialysis, and he had a stroke. And unfortunately, I have been told by the medical personnel, I don't know, you know, myself, but I've been told that the area where he had the stroke is the area that controls your breathing. And he has been on a ventilator since he had the stroke, and which he had in November, and he is not conscious. He's the medical facility, the caseworker told me that the ventilator and the dialysis was keeping him alive, which is what you'll frequently hear.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns how we got involved was we got called by Texas Right to Life because this man's mother is in Texas, and she wants very much to be able to bring him to Texas to take care of him. And the skilled nursing facility where he is, it keeps saying that they're going to discharge him, and I am shocked that they haven't yet, because we've been involved since the beginning of February. And they were saying it then, and they were saying it a couple weeks ago when I talked to the caseworker. So something we're saying or doing is causing them to keep him longer. But in this particular instance, it's very difficult because in Texas they have something called the 10-day rule. And as we were just talking, the place your loved one is, whether it's a skilled nursing facility, whether it's a hospital, they can make now this rule or the 10-day rule in Texas is a law. But basically, what it is that they can say, come and say to you with no reason whatsoever, that we're no longer going to treat your loved one, and you have 10 days to find a place for him or her to go, which can be absolutely devastating, because in a case like this man here in Georgia, it's not easy to find some place that knows that can do dialysis and vent care. This isn't an easy placement.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been trying to work with his mother to help her understand that going to Texas may not be the best thing for him, because if she's working so hard to get him there so she can care for him, and it would be heartbreaking if this wherever he ends up being, if they, you know, he got there and they said, okay, you have 10 days. And,
right.
And, you know, and I mean,
and if
obviously,
he's 50, if
yeah.
he's 50, you know, she's got to be.
At 70 at least.
I mean, at least, well,
yeah.
you would think, or 66. But,
yeah.
but, I mean, it's got to be difficult for her to take care
oh,
of
yeah.
him in her home. So she would need, you know, facility support with him being on a ventilator and needing dialysis. She can't take him home.
No, she can't, because he isn't conscious. I mean,
right.
I know people who have been on dialysis, and if they're conscious, then they can be at home, because you can, you know, you can put them in a wheelchair or whatever, and you can get them in the car and you can take them for their dialysis.
Right.
But she can't do that with him.
No.
So
no,
the good news, the good news is that Julie Grimstad advised. She lives in Texas, and she is
right.
a end of life. I'm telling for your audience. She is an end of life advocate. She is very knowledgeable and very has worked with a lot of people. In difficult situations, but telling his mom about Julie, and that, you know, I told her about the 10-day rule. Catherine with Texas Right to Life told her about the 10-day rule, but it was kind of like telling her about Julie put her over the top. But Julie added something that was critical, and that was Oklahoma is much more life friendly, and maybe we could find a place there. So that's what we're working on now, is trying to find a skilled nursing facility in Texas. I mean, in Oklahoma.
Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
Even Julie has said that if she gets sick and she needs to go to a hospital, she's going to have mm-hmm. her husband drive her to Oklahoma because
yep.
of the 10-day rule in Texas, that she does not want to go to that hospital. So, yeah, and with that, you know, now we have this COVID-19 going on, and you and I talked earlier about what that means to our elderly now, because they're at a bigger risk, because people cannot even get into the nursing facilities and the retirement homes to see their loved ones, to see what kind of shape they're in.
Yes, it's very scary. We have no idea what they're doing, and what has surfaced just recently since the end of March was an article in the Washington Post that said hospitals consider universal do not resuscitate orders for coronavirus patients, which is pretty scary.
Right.
When you think why are we going through all of this if you're just going to let them die when they get to the hospital? It doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, it doesn't. And like you and I were saying, if you're around a person who has this and it's as infectious as they say it is, and you've got the mask on and stuff, what would resuscitating someone do that would cause you to be at bigger risk of getting the disease than you already are. Don't they already have masks and gloves on? So, you know, by using a paddle to bring them back if their heart stopped, how is that going to be put you at any bigger risk than the fact that they're laying in a hospital bed and not dying?
That is a very good question. And so we did a little bit of research to find out what was the policy. And right now the policy is questionable because the government authorities are saying, this is a quote by Roger Severino, the director of the Office of Civil Rights, that's an agency under Health and Human Services, and he says, "We are concerned that crisis standards of care may start relying on value judgments as to the relative worth of one human being versus another based on the presence or absence of a disability." Well, I mean, that sounds like something we would write. You know, we don't want to make value judgments about human beings based on whether they have a disability or not. So this is encouraging. And then there is a doctor, I think she pronounced her name Brooks. I'm trying to find the quote, sorry. I should have highlighted it or something.
Burke.
She's a her.
Yeah, she's a her. Deborah Burks, or Dr.
Yeah.
Deborah Burks. Yeah.
Right. I'm sorry, I can't find it. But she too, there it is. Dr. Deborah Burks, White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator, said during a briefing on Thursday, the country doesn't need a blanket DNR for coronavirus patients. There is no situation in the United States now that warrants this kind of discussion. You can be thinking about it in a hospital. Certainly, many hospitals talk about this on a daily basis. But to say that to an American, but to say that to the American people, to make the implication that when they need a hospital bed, it's not going to be there, or when they need that ventilator, it's not going to be there. We don't have evidence of that right now. So I was very encouraged by what Severino said and what she said. But on the other hand, we have the hospitals themselves, and they are discussing this. And if they are discussing it, that means our radar should be up. That is a huge red flag.
Exactly.
Because they have what they call feudal care boards and their ethics boards, and they can make all kinds of rules regardless of what the official policy of the administration is.
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely.
This is something that we are all facing right now.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, if your loved one goes into the hospital, you have to make sure that you have that you are the healthcare power of attorney, that you are getting, the possibility for abuse here is so huge when you can't be there and there is no oversight. It is very scary.
True.
It is
true. And if you don't, and again, halovoice.org has sample durable power of attorneys per state that you can go in and fill out. But the problem is making sure that that is with the individual. But do you really think a doctor is going to pick up the phone and call you because you can't go there to the facility with them? And
no.
I seriously believe that, same as I tell you that hospice falsifies death certificates, that a lot of the people that died in Washington and just, I heard Maryland, Mount Airy, Maryland, they just lost 5 patients in the nursing home there. And they could put down that it's the coronavirus that they died from, and when in reality, maybe it was something else.
Oh, no.
And they, you know, they have a DNR, and they just let them go, or maybe they gave them too much morphine and out of it. I mean, sadly, I don't have a whole lot of faith that they will blame all of this and say all of this is the coronavirus. That person died from the coronavirus. There's no guarantee that that is what they died from. And they can falsify their record. It makes it easy to clean out and get rid of a lot of the people that they don't value as human beings and see that they have
personhood.
They don't have rights to save money. Absolutely.
I want to let your reader or your listeners know that this isn't some pie in the sky idea that they're going to put DNRs on people. Here in Georgia, someone that I know personally had a friend who was in the hospital. She had had cancer, and she was there, and for whatever reason, her husband, maybe he did this all the time, I don't know, he picked up her chart, and it had a DNR on it. And she did not have a do not resuscitate desire, and he didn't. And when he found it, he went down to the administration of the hospital to find out how this happened, and, of course, they didn't know how it happened. And another instance, my sister is a nurse, and she was in the an ER nurse. And while she was there, someone came in, and the doctor asked, does this person have an advance directive? And he was told yes. And without even looking at it, he marked DNR on that chart. So these things are happening.
They are.
And about the coronavirus, I mentioned earlier that I have been working with someone at Texas Right to Life on this one case. And she shared with me how someone had called them because the husband was in the hospital. He was critical, and she was told by the doctor that it was their policy that anybody with the coronavirus and in critical condition automatically had a DNR on their chart. So it is happening. And Texas Right to Life was able to help her because they have a form that says, you know, hey, what you're doing is not legal. You may not do, you know, but it takes knowledge and it takes boldness, like you said earlier.
That's right.
To not allow this to happen. This woman's husband could have died, but because of Texas Right to Life having that form, because that woman called Texas Right to Life, just like the people that call us, and then we try to help them in various ways. And right now, obviously, the coronavirus is the latest tool in their bag.
Mm-hmm. And that's what it's being used as, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
we have one minute and 20 seconds left. thank you so much for coming on tonight, and you've brought a lot of good information to our listeners, and I hope they are listening. She gave you the information to contact them. There are other Right to Life groups in each state that if you are in this is for Georgia, and we've talked to the one for Texas. I'll try to get some more in here, but check your resources. Go out there and Google things and protect your loved ones. And, you know, God bless everybody. I am concerned about everybody with the virus, what is going on or what isn't going on. The fact is, it's very scary times until it is resolved. So
Until
the 15th.
Thank you, Marcia. I just said thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to your listeners.
Well, I'm glad you came on, and I believe it makes a difference. And is there anything you want to add? You've got 30 seconds.
30 seconds. If there's one thing I could say, go to the websites that Marcia has told you about. Educate yourself. Educate your family. Because once it happens, it's too late. Be proactive. Don't let this kind of thing happen to you or your family.
Amen. I'll second that. Good night, everyone, and thank you again, Genevieve. I love your name. Thank you for coming on tonight and telling us information. And to everyone else, thank you for listening to us. Good night.